Sportsnet 590, The Fan.
Morning show. Sports Step 5 Night of the Fan. JD Bunkus and his best friend.
me or Ben? Oh, no, me.
No, here's the thing. No co-host of mine has ever done something nice for me. All Ben ever did as my co-host was make bets with me, lose, not fully pay on the bets, and then basically just never even acknowledge that I was smarter to have won these bets, but just discredit them with the constant saying that I was lucky. That's our whole friendship. That's it. That's, what else have you, like, you know, what, like, do you ever do anything nice other than welch on bets and trick me? And, you know, it's like, think about the nicest thing you ever did for me on Good Show.
Like on air or
yeah, no,
driving
show.
You across North America to get your dry skin checked out because you thought
what?
You were dying.
Yeah, I
Wait,
may have
what
once.
What is that?
I may have once thought that I had lymphoma rash when it might have been literally the mildest case of one
was
dot of psoriasis near my armpit.
Was that a Tatis Jr. situation?
No, I did have to use steroid cream for three days.
That's
so
a, wow. You should have used that anecdote. Did you bring that to air?
Yeah.
And
no,
you could
I
speak
didn't.
To ringworm.
I didn't.
Ew.
No, that wasn't what it was. It was psoriasis. Oh. It was a small patch of dry skin near my armpit that I thought was lymphoma rash because I am a hypochondriac. And yeah, Ben may have forced me to go to the hospital or the clinic because I was going nuts about it and refused to go. But on air, you've done nothing actually good for me, including this, which is again another sewering where it's just like, hey, this is what it is. Again, Ailish, you have completely solidified your spot into the best friend category. I will say this. The lesson from that is everybody just, you know, go get things checked because probably not as bad as you think it is. And if you're like me, it's like, oh, no. For me, it's like a Schrodinger's cat situation where once you open the box, it's real, right? You know, like now you've done it. You've done the thing. As long as you ignore.
Oh, yeah.
Who knows?
It's really good advice to just ignore things until.
No, I'm saying
possibly.
Don't.
No, okay. So, that is actually good advice. Yeah. No, go to the professional, healthcare workers that can actually help you with your problems is a good idea. Especially if you are like you, where your brain does the domino effect thing where, you know, it goes from one thing to a worse thing to a worse thing to a worse thing. Mm-hmm. And it took over your life for like a week. Where like it was all you could talk about how you were dying of leukemia.
Yep. Yeah, it was lymphoma, but get it right.
Sorry.
But yeah, this insider, by the way, is brought to you by Don Valley North Lexus. Truly an insider, the only person that knows that personal detail of my life.
Now everybody
you
does.
I might sue you. But yeah, where you can expect excellence online and in the showroom, visit DonValleyNorthLexus.com. Ben Ennis, host of The Fan Drive Time. So if we're going to, you know, use health as the theme, what do you need from Springer down the stretch? Like, and is this just because to me, last night was a reminder that he's no longer a center fielder for the Toronto Blue Jays. Like, this is just that era of his career to me should be over because no one cares what George Springer does in center field. They don't want him occupying the DH spot every single night or coming in as, you know, a pinch hitter a lot of the nights because he needs to be rested. But moving forward, like, I'll put it this way. Over under, let's say, 45.5 games in center field for George Springer as a Toronto Blue Jay.
Oh, you mean his whole career?
Yeah.
Okay, because I was focused on this season. I don't want to see him play the outfield during the regular season.
Oh, there's no chance that he's doing that this year.
No,
he's got a bionic
disagree.
Arm. You think he's playing center field again this year?
You didn't see the comments pregame from John Schneider yesterday that this is like he's starting to throw. This is something that they want him to do in the coming days. when you get to the postseason, all bets are off, and you do really kind of have to push the limits, right? You have to be a little bit riskier because it's such a small sample. You have a chance to do something, and even if it cost George Springer like the first couple of months of next regular season, if you have a chance to win a World Series, it doesn't matter. Uh-huh. You put him in the lineup, you give yourself the best chance to win.
Yeah.
But I mean, this is how passionate I am about this. I understand that him as the primary DH for the rest of the season means perilously few Alejandro Kirk starts. I don't care. Like, mm-hmm. George Springer is way more important than Alejandro Kirk. And
yep.
I don't know the severity of the injury, and there's probably going to be some weirdo scope surgery at the end of the season. And they can talk all they want about the possibility of re-injuring the elbow being low if he's throwing, and it's not playing it. No, I'm telling you for a fact that it's not even the elbow. This guy is like the Carlo Colaiacovo of the Toronto Blue Jays, that like an anvil is going to fall on his head, right? Like he's star-crossed as far as injuries are concerned. And if he's playing only half of the game, then he's less likely to get injured. So I'd have him DH the rest of the season.
I genuinely believe, like, okay, so we've done a lot of, hey, what's at stake this season? Like, whose jobs are on the line? Because Charlie Montoya was fired, right? And they've taken a starting pitcher out of the rotation and who is likely now never going to return, and Yusei Kikuchi. Like, this is an all-in season in a lot of different ways for people in terms of what is on the line. We did it come trade deadline, right? Like, hey, what's the scenario where someone in the front office is pressed potentially out of a job? I don't know how you could possibly come back with everybody here if you let George Springer play in center field and now he gets hurt down the stretch run again playing center field, and then your season falls apart. Like, you're right. His bat is the thing that you need in the lineup.
And you got insurance at the trade deadline to kind of cover this. Like, wasn't that why they got those players?
They've got 100 different guys mm-hmm. who can play center field right now. And like Jackie Bradley Jr., sure, he's basically an automatic out. He is, I will say, I was kind of reluctant to go, hey, what's even the point of swapping out Bradley Zimmer for this guy? At least he can run into one every once in a while. So there you go. That's the point of doing it. Well, he did. He had the double in the first game against Boston. I don't recall Bradley Zimmer having too many of those. But yeah, he's mostly an automatic out. But again, it's a who cares situation, because as long as George Springer comes up at the top of the order every night, I think you're happy as a Blue Jays fan, regardless of, what the ripple effect of that is, whether it's less Kirk or more Jackie Bradley Jr.'s and Ramel Tapia's, I'm fine with it. You got to have the guy healthy. You can't win without him. Like, you cannot win without him.
No, and he's been a good defender in center field, too. Like, he's outside of Jackie Bradley Jr., he is your best defender there, because Ramel Tapia can't really play the position.
No, Ramel Tapia is terrible there.
And, like, game one of the postseason, George Springer's in center field. That's the reality for me.
But that's why I set the over-under at 45.5, is that I think that he will remain playing that spot in this year's playoff run, and I think next year he'll have the odd day where he plays center field. But I don't see how he's going to be able to justify it, because what's he going to say to them? He's going to come back and go, I still want to be the center fielder. Like, that means something to me. And they're going to go, yeah, except here's the deal, bro. Look at the amount of games you've played healthy here over the first 2 years. We can't justify this anymore. Like, you need to play in a lower leverage defensive position.
Well, the other part of this as well is that he's been primarily, when he's playing the outfield for the Blue Jays, he's been primarily a center fielder. But go back to his last couple of seasons in Houston, he was playing a lot of the corner outfield spot, right?
Yeah,
like
he was.
In 2019, he played more right field than he played center field, or just about as much, right? He was already transitioning off of center field. They obviously can't go into a season where they know he's playing a corner outfield spot and have Jackie Bradley Jr. as the center fielder. Like, that's an off-season thing where, like, maybe they revisit the Michael Conforto thing or whatever. They need to acquire somebody who's actually capable offensively and capable of playing that position. But no, the idea that he's going to be a primary center fielder going into another year, no, that's not correct.
Do you believe in the Jose Berríos adjustment?
No, because, okay, I mean, maybe. Like, but how many of these stories do we have to see this season before we say, yeah, okay, I guess, like, he can be good. He's had stretches of like he's had almost a month where he's been as dominant as any pitcher in all of baseball. I had to double check this because it seemed impossible. He's the same number of quality starts as Kevin Gausman. They both have 13 this year. That's crazy. Because he's got a couple of good starts in a row doesn't mean that the next one isn't going to be like two outs and 85 earned runs. It means nothing. He's having the strangest season I can remember a Blue Jay starter ever having, and I defer to the smart people who get the gifts, like the Arden Zwellings who have the gifts in their back pocket. They got the treasure trove of gifts, and they try to show me the adjustments and which part of the slab he's on and how different that is. And the one thing that I do kind of buy into is the hiding the baseball a little bit more, because I do think when he gets into trouble, it has to be pitch tipping, right? Because they hit the ball so hard off him, and it's part of the reason he wears that mouth guard thing, because he was apparently doing certain things with his mouth that was indicating fastball or breaking ball, whatever. But no, just because he has a good start. You can't. I mean, just go back throughout the season.
Well, there's the numbers that indicate the four-seamer has been getting worse year over year. But yeah, that's... I just wanted you to finish that point. But that is the other thing with it, is it's not like just the pitch tipping. There is some stuff that, with all the gifts that you've talked about, like the fastball and the command of it have been called into question a lot at times this year.
Yeah, I don't know what's happening. Still, it should be good enough to get through an outing without giving up 8 runs, I think. Generally, he's a good enough pitcher to be what they asked him to be, which is not the best pitcher. He started opening day, but not even the ace of the staff. Everybody knew that the upside was higher with Manoah and Gausman. Did they expect them to have way better seasons than Jose Berríos? No. Jose Berríos was supposed to be a guy that had an ERA in the mid threes, in and around 4, but every fifth day kept you in a baseball game. And he hasn't done that.
Okay.
His ceiling has actually been pretty high. But no, the baseline's been horrible.
Playoff start tonight. Is Stripling or Berríos in the 3-man rotation?
How do you keep Ross Stripling out of the rotation right now? He's got the fourth best ERA in the American League among starters since June, right? If it's a meritocracy. The thing is, he's still not, he's thrown 90 pitches in a game once this season. He's still not seeing a lineup 3 times through. Especially in that wild. I don't know what those wild card rounds are going to look like. It's so weird. The 3-game series, all 3 games at home, and that 3rd game is super short leash, right? So, and it's all hands on deck, and depending on what Manoah or Gausman did in game 1, maybe they're coming back, and because maybe it's a throw day for them that they can come out of the bullpen in one of those games. But yeah, on merit, hard to argue against Ross Stripling at this point.
Yeah, it's so far down the line for me that if we're doing it as a hypothetical, it's fun because you're going, well, which guy on merit would be the actual starter? The question to me should actually be, who would you have more trust in starting a game 3 if it was today? Rather than, does it happen come playoff time for the reasons that you just outlined? And, lining up the schedule and trying to get into that spot, potentially having your last day of the season where you're maybe trying to get in that spot. Maybe you're trying to position yourself with a wild card or get home field advantage. Who knows? But either way, it's a tough one to predict right now. I wonder, if this is how you feel about this take. I was thinking about this last night with Berríos because he pitched well. I wonder if he's going to kind of inherit the R.A. Dickey position of a guy who gives you a ton of innings, a guy who everyone looks back on the trade and still says, maybe he wasn't exactly what they expected him to be, but he's still pretty, he's quality. He can go out there, give you innings. He can pitch well. And at the end of the year, his ERA is going to be above 4 and below 5. And that's fine for a team that's going to be, competitive and have a bunch of other guys that can maybe bump him down. I don't know. What do you think about this? I see a smile on your face. So it's I don't know. I think that there's at least a little bit of a parallel. I was thinking about it last night.
Without looking, because I don't think you have it up anyways. What do you think R.A. Dickey's ERA as a Blue Jay was in 131 games?
4:45.
4:05. Like, it was almost four.
Yeah, that's four. That's what I mean. Yeah, like, I thought it would have been higher because I thought it would have got inflated at the end, but... yeah, no, that's what I'm saying, is like, why can't he be new R.A. Dickey, where you go, hey, maybe some people who thought he was supposed to be an ace, because like, some people even came in this year and they said that Jose Berríos could win Cy Young. Like that was really a position. We had Dallas Braden on, he thought that. We had Ricky Romero, he thought that that was going to be potential. A lot of people were looking at, especially the Matt Chapman edition, saying this is going to help Jose Berríos more than anybody else. I just wonder if that's what he's going to end up being here, is the next R.A. Dickey, but just different. God.
I am Mr. R.A. Dickey defender. I don't think I defend him hard enough. Like, so the first year, 4.21 ERA, threw 224 innings, 215 in two-thirds innings the next year, 3.71, 3.91. He had two seasons as a Blue Jay where he threw over 200 innings with an ERA under 4. Like, okay, if that's, wow, what a disappointment that would be. If Jose Berríos threw over 200 innings with an ERA under 4 for this Blue Jays team, we'd be singing his praises. We'd be putting a statue of him in front of Rogers Center. And the R.A. Dickey thing was, yes, you didn't know what you were going to get. You didn't know if he'd be able to right himself mid-start. That was, like, the most frustrating thing, because even
Which reminds me of who?
Well, I mean... You can see it happening to Berríos, where he has the blow-up innings, he gets the base runners on, and then he gives up the big hit, and then it does totally come undone. He hasn't actually done what Dickey did, which was sometimes he would look like, oh, this guy's not going to get an out, and then end up going 5 or 6, right? What Berríos is doing when he's bad is that it's so bad, he can't get it righted. You actually know it's not going to be righted.
It's not a perfect parallel, but I think it's damn near close. Like, if you look back at Jose Berríos the last 2 years, or I think 3 seasons, he's had 200 innings pitched. He's been a workhorse. Mm-hmm. He stays healthy. And if you look at what his arsenal is and his ability to blow up, but also his ability to the odd night go out there and just absolutely dominate, I think you're going to see a guy that, yeah, hasn't, like I said, an ERA north of 4 year over year, who gives you bulk, who's able, like, the only reason he doesn't have more innings this year is because of all the explosions, right? It's not like they've been managing him in a different way. He's been healthy. He's been fine. I just, no. Like, it's the eye of the beholder thing, where you're going to have the odd person, like you said, who's an R.A. Dickey defender, who goes, hey, this guy's better than you think, and he tells a person who is not an R.A. Dickey defender, an R.A. Dickey hater, and they went, no, this guy stinks, and he's not living up to what I thought he was going to be, because what I thought he was going to be is someone that they traded Noah Syndergaard for and Travis d'Arnaud, and was supposed to be a Cy Young winner, and he never came here and, like, absolutely, you know, dominated. And maybe that's just not going to be the bar for Berríos, and maybe the R.A. Dickey experience has actually prepared us a little bit for this. Anyways, I was
I don't think it's a bad comparison. I really don't. Like I said, I think if he produced the R.A. Dickey numbers, you'd be pleased as punch. And another thing to think back on R.A. Dickey is that it was, I know it's like fewer than 10 years ago, offense in baseball was up. In the era that R.A. Dickey pitched, and the baseline for pitching is higher now because batters are hitting like 230 as a collective, and it's the fourth worst season for batting average in the modern history of baseball.
Last one from me before you go. Yesterday night, the Jays played some really good defense, and it got me thinking, where are you at right now heading into the postseason stretch about where this team is defensively? Because part of it is that they had to bring in Jackie Bradley Jr. to play center field for this, you know, George Springer who's hurt. So that does change things a little bit. But you and I, whenever we've done shows together and whenever we've talked to, you know, the people, person after person, when we've been setting up the Blue Jays for the last 2 years, we talked a lot about team defense. And last night, it reminded me of, to me personally anyways, how far they've come.
Yeah, this is a good defensive team by every metric. And the metrics tell you that Matt Chapman's not having a great season defensively, which, yes, you can quibble with. And he had an incredible
And by quibble play. With, I can say I strongly disagree with and say this is why nobody trusts your numbers, nerds.
Right. I mean, yeah, Mike Petriello did a good job of, again, with his gifts that he holds in the utility belt, of showing some of the moments this season that Matt Chapman hasn't gotten the ball from his glove to his hand all that effectively. But yeah, no, this defense is good all the way around. And part of the reason they've been so good especially in the outfield, is because of the defensive positioning. I don't know if you saw this the other day, but Mark Simon of Sats and Info had a great post about how the Blue Jays are creating more defensive runs saved in the outfield because of their defensive alignments than any team in baseball. And that makes sense because they are shifting. They're doing that four-man outfield thing more than anybody else in baseball. But yeah, like the Teoscar Hernandez, Lourdes Gurriel defensive issues that we've seen in the past haven't been as evident because they've just been put in better spots to succeed. They've been shored up by, at times, being surrounded by an extra infielder. So no, I mean, what is your biggest question mark defensively about this team? I would still say, despite the fact that he's been a pretty good defender at the position and at least a league average defender, it's Bo Bichette. But I wouldn't say that it's like a Russ Adams situation, but I think Bo Bichette, if you're looking at the weaker parts of this defense, I think he's probably the weakest part.
Okay, Ben, we got to do something to chew on, brought to you by Great Canadian Meats.
Yum, yum, yum.
Looking ahead to next year, Blue Jays 2024 schedules are released, including some big changes, a balanced schedule. So everybody plays everybody. That'll be 46 interleague games, so more than twice as many compared to previous seasons. Going to play some new faces. 52 matchups against the AL East rivals, Yankees and Rays in April, May, and then not seeing any of them until late September. What were your thoughts on just like how this is going to match up, and do you like the balanced schedule?
Oh my God, I've been screaming about a balanced schedule
finally.
For years. I mean, it makes, especially when you have an additional wild card spot. So the Blue Jays are playing mm-hmm. for the same playoff spot as the White Sox and the Twins and the Guardians, but they have to play the Yankees and Red Sox 1,000 more times than those teams. And you still do play your division a little bit more. You play your divisional opponents 13 times, but it's 19 times now. Blue Jays play the Yankees, Red Sox, Orioles, and Rays 19 times this season, and it goes down to 13. I think it makes all the sense in the world. I mean, it shouldn't be that extreme to say, hey, you know, all the teams in baseball, you should play them every year. That's what this is as well, right? That's where the extra interleague play games come in. You play each National League team either home or away every 2 years. And you play every National League team at least in one series every single year. I love it. I love it. I love mm-hmm. it. I love it. It levels the playing field. You don't get to get away with murder if you are those those White Sox teams playing the Royals 19 times or, you know, the other mediocre AL Central teams. I love it.
So you're right. Let me just start with that. You're right, and yes. I agree.
That's it. But okay, just, see you guys. No,
but just to play contrarian here, two things. Baseball is trying to make a lot of changes all at once, and a lot of it, I think, is, you know, okay, fine, it's all right. But I do look at it and say, what is the audience that you're trying to capture? Because from a national level, I just don't think baseball is ever going to be a national sport again. I think it's going to be regional forever. And this is exemplified by something that I talked with Ailish about earlier in the show, which is, yeah, you know what is like the most popular story in baseball to push around social media this year? It's trumpets. It's entrance music for Edwin Diaz. Like, it's not about Aaron Judge. It's not about Shohei Ohtani. It's none of that. It's not about the Dodgers' dominance or anything along those lines. The national story is, on social media anyways, and on the internet, is here's a guy who comes out to cool trumpets and marches down to the diamond. And that's what people know it for right now. When I go to a baseball game and there is an interleague team in town, and I know I only get a chance to see them once every couple of years, mm-hmm. I kind of feel special getting to go to that game. Like, when I saw Clayton Kershaw pitch here in 2016, and I went down and I got to watch Kershaw pitch, I didn't just feel like I was watching one of the game's greatest pitchers ever. I also felt like, hey, I came down here. I got to the Dodgers game. There's something special about that ticket that means something, especially in a regional sport and in cities where, yeah, events kind of matter. And making a sport an event and making an evening an event and adding a layer of entertainment to it is fun. The other thing is that divisions have been losing their importance across sports for a long time now. You've seen it in the NBA, right? It's like, oh yeah, the Atlantic doesn't mean anything anymore. It used to mean seeding in a playoff. Same with the NFL. It's all just kind of going a little bit by the wayside. But I think rivalries matter. And so for a regional sport, why do sports have to be fair? Like, who signed up and said that these are supposed to be fair and that everyone does need to have the exact same schedule? Like, I'm just saying that if we're going to say the sport is about regional rivalries and that's a regional sport, then I'd rather see them play the team from the region more than I'd like to see them play a team like the Arizona or the St. Louis Cardinals, who can't even bring their good players here because of vaccinations.
They're going to get the Padres too. Padres, Diamondbacks, Giants. Those are some of the names coming.
Yeah.
You almost had it. The first part of the argument was I was buying it for a second, despite the fact that, yeah, okay.
I got you on the sentimental stuff to your heart. I knew that that was the way into the
argument. No, that was good because, yeah, when interleague play came in, that was, hey, this is not special anymore when these two teams meet in the World Series, right, where they never see each other during the course of a regular season.
Which is outrageous. That was such an outrageous position.
But
it won't be special
to
make a World Series anymore. Like, oh, you saw the Cubs for a two-game set? Like, now who cares?
Yeah, you would never see the pitcher hit. Like, rarely would you watch National League Baseball, and then all of a sudden you get into this world. It's like, oh, they have to play a different sport for the championship against a team they've never seen before. Sweet. So I can kind of buy that. But it is still special when you only see the Dodgers at home once every 2 years. Mm-hmm. Like, that's still special. And I think, obviously, if there was an extra buck to be made, I think Major League Baseball also did a financial accounting of this schedule and realized that this makes them as much, if not more, money. Mm-hmm. Second part is, who said
the
sports
money
should be fair? Like, I kind of think that, they're not fair, but the goal is fairness. What are you talking about? Who said sports should be fair? No, okay, let's start because Major League Baseball wants the Yankees to win. Yankees get to start every count with a 1-0, the one ball. They start, Aaron Judge steps to the plate, and before a pitch is thrown, it's one ball, zero strikes, because it's not fair. Sorry, nobody said sports were going to be fair, but the Yankees need to be the best team in baseball and winning a World Series. No, and it's still not fair. You still do play your division more than the other teams, but it's closer to fair. What are you talking about?
So this is a sport that prides itself on, hey, we can have different dimensions to ballparks so that it's less fair for the visiting team than it is for the home team.
No, they both play in the same ballpark. It's not
Red
Sox play in Fenway. What?
One group can design their team more easily than the other in order to have like a home field advantage. I'm saying that's not fair. I'm playing devil's advocate, and I'm just saying that I kind of convinced myself that I'm right. You know, that's all. Just admit
defeat. I gave you credit on the first part. The second part was stupid. Admit it.
No, I refuse to admit it. I refuse to admit it. Of course, that's who I am. That's in my bones. Ben Ennis, you were our insider today, brought to you by Don Valley North Lexus. Thanks so much for making time, buddy.
All right. See you guys. Thanks.
See you, pal. Yes, that insider was brought to you by Don Valley North Lexus, where you can expect excellence online and in the showroom. Visit DonValleyNorthLexus.com. When we come back, Ailish Forfar. One-on-one.
The poet.
The poet. The poet and the Palmer.
Ooh.
Carson Palmer, next on the Fan Morning Show. JD and Ailish, Sportsnet 590, The Fan.
Sportsnet 590, The Fan.
Glad to be joined by Carson Palmer, former NFL quarterback, 2003 first overall pick, three-time Pro Bowler, and Heisman Trophy winner. Hi, Carson. Thanks for joining us this morning.
Thanks for having me.
So football season just around the corner. We've been getting our fair share of preseason, but we're going to look ahead just a couple weeks from now at everything kicking off. Buffalo Bills obviously been poised to be Super Bowl favorites this year, led by Josh Allen. What do you make of where he's at heading into this important season ahead?
I think they're primed. I mean, last year was such a disappointment to make it that far, to play that well. And then get beat the way they did at the end of the game there against the Chiefs. You know, they've got a little taste of it. They've got you know, a distaste in their mouth of what it's like to work so hard and get that far and then, you know, have the season end in such a dramatic fashion when you think you got the game and you think you're going to the next round. So they've got that kind of chip on their shoulder and that that natural hunger to get to the next round and get to the next level. And they've got the quarterback, they've got the receiver, they've got the you know, a stout defense. They can stop the run. They've got some really good speed on the back end at the cornerback position. So it's just a really well-rounded team with McDermott, who I think is a great young coach, and he's got some experience now. So I just think, you know, this could be their year. This really feels like it could be their year. They've got the right recipe heading into this season.
What's it like to be that face that has to kind of weigh expectations, lead the way for a franchise that probably has the most excitement around it since the 90s?
It's just exciting. You know, it's there's nothing else going on in Buffalo other than the Bills. And, you know, that can get overwhelming for some guys, but not for a guy like Josh. I think Josh seems like he just revels in it and just loves that atmosphere. And that's what you want. You want a quarterback that feels comfortable in that environment. You don't want a quarterback that's shying away from it or feeling the pressure of it. There's no doubt Josh and that team feel the pressure of the expectations they have. And that fan base is so loyal and they've been through so much, all the Super Bowls and being so close. There's new hype. There's new hope. There's anticipation for this group being able to maybe be the group that gets the Super Bowl and gets over that hump. So that expectation and that pressure is what a guy like Josh Allen just revels and lives for.
So new offensive coach for Josh Allen, what is that kind of transition like? Is it a difficult role to shift into, and how much leadership does he take in this offseason to really control what's ahead?
It's a huge loss. I mean, Brian Daboll's been around the league for a long time. He's coached on great staffs. He's coached tons of great players. He's had a ton of success. I mean, that I think that has really been underplayed. He has been such a great coach wherever he's been, and it really looks like the New York Giants are headed in the right direction under his leadership. So, you know, I think that's a piece that they got to figure out. It's easy to go, oh, well, you know, we lost a coach, we'll get a new one. It ain't that easy, unfortunately. There's not a whole bunch of great coaches just waiting in the wings. So, you know, part of that falls on Josh, part of that falls on McDermott, part of that falls on the rest of that veteran group they have on offense. That's something they have to overcome. It's not going to be as easy as it was in years past. There's not going to be as many easy touchdowns that are dialed up, because it's such a great play call, because that's what Daboll did. Daboll got you easy completions. He found a way to get the ball in Stephon Diggs' hands early. You know, that I feel like that has been kind of glossed over, and people haven't realized quite yet just how big of a loss that is. So, you know, it's hard to overcome, but if anybody can overcome it, it's a great coaching staff that McDermott has in place with some veteran leadership, which he does now have in place, because Josh is no longer a rookie. He's no longer in year two. Now he's a vet. He's a leader. He's, you know, he's got the big contract. He's got all those things. So he'll fill into that void. But finding those easy completions and finding those mismatches that Brian Daboll did such a great job of creating over the last couple of years is going to be really difficult to replace.
So what do you think were those main areas circled this offseason for Josh Allen and the Bills in terms of just taking that extra step? It seems like it just needs to be a little step, but it makes an entirety of a difference making that postseason run.
Yeah, I mean, I hope the thing that we see that they've worked on as the season unfolds is a way to make sure Josh Allen's not carrying the ball as much and getting hit as much. And I know he's a big physical you know, specimen at quarterback, but I just don't like seeing the quarterback take those kinds of hits. Those add up. He's not 25 anymore. He's starting to get closer to 30. As you start to get closer to 30, little shoulder here, little hip injury here, little hamstring, little knee. I mean, there's so many things that start to creep up that you see over the last 50 years, you know, 60 years of the NFL. The more times your quarterback's getting hit, the more times your organization is susceptible. And I love Josh's game. I love that he's a runner and he can take off and make plays with his feet. But I just hope that they can find ways you know, three or four less carries per game on his shoulders. Maybe those three or four plays are reverses to Stephon Diggs or finding another way to get the ball in a ball carrier's hands that isn't Josh Allen. That's not the face of your franchise. You know, as the Buffalo Bills go, Josh Allen goes. And I just would like to see them find more creative ways to get the ball in different players' hands, that it's not Josh Allen streaking down the field, taking a hit from a linebacker or safety.
Mm-hmm. Well, lots of attention been on the Bills, obviously, because of their big, lofty expectations this season. But my God, I got to ask you about this Raiders, Dana White, Tom Brady drama that has stolen the spotlight over the last week. Former Raider, what would this have been? What kind of world would we be living in if Dana White's claim that he was involved in this Brady Gronk to the Raiders situation actually came true?
Well, I mean, had he gone to the Raiders, I don't know, maybe they win a Super Bowl. Mm-hmm. We'll never know, obviously. But I think at the end of the day, when it came down to Tom Brady signing his name on a dotted line, I think when he went to Tampa, he went to the most talented team. And I do think the Raiders were talented 2 years ago, and they're still talented. But at that moment in time, that team was absolutely loaded. Who they had on defense, they could rush the passer, they could cover you on the back end. They have so many weapons at receiver. They had, you know, Leonard Fournette and, you know, a stable of backs and a really, really good offensive line. So, I mean, I don't put too much to it. I don't think Derek Carr is putting too much to it. Anytime you're replaced by the greatest ever, you can't really look at that as a knock. I mean, you can't bow your head down and be mad at that. You know, if Tom Brady takes your job, Tom Brady takes your job. But at the end of the day, like I said, I just think Brady went at that moment in 2020 to the best team, and the best team ended up winning the Super Bowl.
And I know you're quite high on Derek Carr and this season, big expectations as well with the Raiders. So I believe I read that you said if Derek Carr plays an entire season the way he played the first four games, they could win the Super Bowl. And what elements of his game is it that gives you such confidence looking ahead to this upcoming season?
Well, he can do it all. I mean, he can throw the ball extremely accurate underneath. He can throw the deep ball really, really well. You know, when he's had really dominant offensive lines, he's played great. So when he has protection, he can absolutely get the job done. You know, and you look back at the first four games of last year, it was before the Henry Ruggs car accident. It was before John Gruden got fired. Before all the turmoil of last year, he was a dominant player. He was getting protection and stepping into throws. When he can step into throws, he can throw it as good as anybody. And then when teams started bringing cover zero and really blitzing him and trying to put a bunch of pressure on him, they were making teams pay for it. They were throwing the ball over the top. He had Henry Ruggs on big post patterns and was throwing long touchdowns for game winners and really making defenses pay when they took risks. And so he lost Henry Ruggs. He lost John Gruden. They went through just turmoil and distractions and chaos throughout last year. And it's just hard to play at a high level for 17 weeks when your head coach is in the media and then he's fired and there's a new guy when – you know, you have a player that's in, you know, a car accident like that, a horrific accident where somebody loses their life. I mean, those are massive distractions to get past and hard to deal with during the season. So hopefully things have calmed down. Hopefully they can stay healthy at the offensive line position. Because like I said, when he can step into throws and has time in the pocket, now that he's got Devontae Adams, they have some more weapons, they're a dangerous team.
So a season without distractions, hopefully, not having, you know, as you mentioned, all that extra drama. Do you think that he's got the supporting cast around him to really elevate the entire team past where they were last postseason?
Well, when you look at the combination of Jacobs at running back, who was a first round pick out of Alabama, who's been really, really good, but has been hurt. You look at Devontae Adams, who's been a dominant player, who's got a good history with Derek since they were college teammates at Fresno State. And then you've got Darren Waller, again, when he's healthy, he was hurt a bunch last year. When he's healthy, he's one of the top two or three tight ends in the league. So it really comes down to staying healthy, just like every team. But when you've got Derek Carr, Devontae Adams, Darren Waller, and Jacobs in the backfield, you've got the potential to score on anybody at any point from any position on the field. So I think that's why they're dangerous. But keeping those guys healthy and on the field at the same time is going to be their challenge this year.
Mm-hmm. So on the other side, Devontae Adams no longer supporting someone like an Aaron Rodgers, who had flirted with the idea of leaving Green Bay last season. Now he's signed that 3-year extension without that support. Do you think Rodgers has the offense to make this Green Bay team competitive?
Oh, absolutely. He's always got, when you have Aaron Rodgers, you've always got the offense to be competitive. It doesn't really matter who they've put out there. We've all seen multiple players that are mid to low to late round draft picks to even college free agents that have contributed. And Aaron at the beginning of his career had Donald Driver, and you can go on and on down the list. I mean, great, great receivers at the ends of their career. So he was really shaped by those players that he played with, especially that Super Bowl year. So he's seeing greatness, and then as those guys, you know, continue to play elsewhere and move on like Devontae Adams has, he's found a way with, you know, just a number of receivers that weren't first round picks or second round picks or third round picks or huge free agent signings. They're just kind of guys they found along the way that were able to make plays. So you've always got offense as long as you have Aaron Rodgers. I think the interesting thing in Green Bay this year is they could be really good on defense, and we just haven't had an Aaron Rodgers team that was a dominant defensive football team. If this team is as good as some of the reports we're hearing out of training camp early in Green Bay, that's something we really haven't seen. We've seen Aaron, like I just said, play with the dominant receiver cores that he had that Super Bowl year, and then transition into some really good players at the receiver position with one dominant receiver in Devontae Adams. But we just haven't seen Aaron with a dominant top two or three defense in the league. And there's a lot of talks how good this defense can be, that they can rush the passer. They've got some playmakers at corner and safety. They've got speed at linebacker, and they've got depth. So this is something we haven't seen. I mean, that if you're a quarterback in, you know, year 14, 15, 16, and you're 30-something years old, a great defense is so nice to have. It's such a comfort blanket. It's so nice to feel I don't have to score 45 points a game. If we can just score 21, we'll probably hold them to 17. That's a position we have not seen Aaron in. So I'm excited to see how this whole thing shakes out on the other side of the ball in Green Bay this year.
And obviously Aaron Rodgers being quite forward about his use of mushrooms and how that's really helped him elevate his team, his play, and with the back-to-back MVPs, you think that there could be a three-peat ahead and maybe one of the first times ever?
I think it's going to be tough. I think it's going to be tough. I mean, they've got to stay healthy at running back. A.J. Dillon was not healthy for some of last year. And so, you know, you lose Devontae Adams. I mean, that's a, you know, 1,300-yard receiver that probably caught 7 to 10 touchdowns throughout those years. And you take away 1,300 yards and you know, double-digit touchdowns from one player, from one player at the receiver position, it's just hard to duplicate. It's hard to find that. You've got to figure out how you're going to replace that. And it looks like they're trying to replace it on defense and not have to have that production. So, you know, to win it three times in a row is really tough, especially when you lose your comfort blanket that he lost in Devontae Adams, who was his third down machine. I mean, he was looking for him in the red zone. He was looking for him on third down, and he was also looking for him in their deep play action game. So I don't see him repeating without having somebody that just shocks the world and has, you know, 1,000 yards and 95 catches this year. I don't know if they have that guy on their roster that maybe we haven't heard of yet.
Mm-hmm. Well, time to find somebody that comes out of the woodwork maybe and impresses. We're talking to Carson Palmer, former NFL quarterback. I've got to ask you about another off-season storyline, which made headlines. The Kyler study clause, Kyler Murray having to, you know, have 4 hours of independent study a week. What do you make of this being put in and then taken away from the clause? And how do you know if he actually studies enough? Like, can you tell that from the outside?
You know, it's who knows? I mean, we won't know. But what a PR nightmare. I mean, that,
oh my God,
that was a bad look. It was a bad look. You know, it's given, you know, fortunately for Kyler, it's given Kyler some leverage for the rest of his career as an Arizona Cardinal. He can always go back to that. If he's in a contract negotiation, or, you know, he demands a trade at some point, or he demands a certain player they draft or go after in free agency, he's always got a chip to play. He's always got some leverage from that, because it was such a debacle. I just think, regardless of how much he studies or how much he doesn't study, I just think at the end of the day, he needs to stay healthy, and he needs to be available and playing at a high level when they're in a big divisional game within the NFC West, or they're in a playoff game with the Rams in LA, whatever it is, he needs to stay healthy. I mean, he's banged up the last two seasons at the end of the year with a couple different little things, little injuries that he needs to find a way to be able to go out and play through those injuries and play with that pain and play at a higher level.
Isn't that just the theme of all quarterbacks this year? You got to stay healthy, and you got to play to your level that everyone expects. And one of those players is Joe Burrow. And I mean, last year it was a very, I think, surprising turnout for a lot of people. They've been kind of under the radar, at least this postseason, after being in the Super Bowl last year. Are the Bengals a team that you can see continuing to grow off of last season?
I think so. It's going to be tough. I think they will get better. I think they've, you know, had a chance to realize, hey, we can do it. We, you know, we're not the Bengals of old. We can get to the Super Bowl. Unfortunately, they're not going to sneak up on anybody. Everybody's going to be ready for them. Everybody's going to be prepared. You know, you're the defending AFC champs. You're the defending Super Bowl representative of the AFC. Where last year, you know, you're getting ready to play the Bengals, and it was like, oh, well, they won a couple games the year before. Well, you know, we don't need to play our best. They're going to get their best shot from everybody. They did not probably get their best shot from every team they played against last year. So, you know, it'll be a tough repeat. They've got an extremely challenging schedule. They've really revamped the offensive line, which was so nice to see. It was so nice to see them go out and realize they had a hole to fill, and they filled it. I mean, there's no doubt. They drastically got better up front. So I do look for them to continue to play at an extremely high level like they were at the end of last season. I just don't know that, you know, they're going to get some of the wins they had last year, where they just snuck up behind a couple teams at the end and scored 14 points in the fourth quarter. And all of a sudden the opposing team was like, wait a minute, we just lost. What happened? We were in control of this game. Because, you know, when you're the Bengals of old, teams can kind of take their foot off the gas pedal. And now that they're, like I said, the AFC representative in the championship game, I mean, they're not going to catch teams that are going to take their foot off the pedal. They know who Ja'Marr Chase is. They know who Joe is. They know, you know, how fine that line is between a win and a loss against a really good team. So they're going to get everybody's best shot this year.
Joe Burrow being, you know, one of the coolest kids on the field last season, a pleasure to watch, but had that ruptured appendix a couple days or weeks ago at this point. Once he's back to full health, which is hopefully soon, what are the steps, if any, that he needs to make this season and still in his young career?
Well, he got beat up so much in his first couple of years that there's probably a little bit of a mistrust in his mind on his offensive line. And, you know, when you're constantly getting hurt, and constantly getting hit, and then you blow your knee out because of a protection issue up front, it's easy to not quite trust that group in front of you. He's got to find a way to change his mindset, and just he's got probably the best offensive line in the league from top to bottom. So he needs to go into games with and get past and get over that hurdle of, I only have 3.5 seconds to 3.75 seconds. He needs to get to that next level of, you know, I'm going to sit in this pocket until I'm forced out of it. I've got more time. I've got more patience. I can be more patient with the passing game. I can get a little deeper in my job. I mean, there's so many things that change mindset-wise when you revamp an offensive line and bring in four completely new guys that are all either extremely highly paid or have great resumes from their you know, handful of first years in the league. So, you know, I just think it's really a mental game with him of being able to trust that group and know that he can count on them to hold up when, you know, at the end of the fourth quarter, when you're having to drive for that game-winning field goal or touchdown, having that confidence, you know, is going to be something that he's going to have to get comfortable with.
Definitely comes with age and experience, and he certainly got a lot of that last year. Seems like there's so many interesting storylines already coming out, looking ahead to the season. Carson, really appreciate you joining us this morning. Looking forward to chatting with you a little bit later in the season.
Thanks for having me.